This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. Coming up on the show today, Australia's new government promises action on climate change, and you're going to hear about what this means specifically for Pacific countries. Also talking climate change, $47 million will be invested into climate adaptation projects in Vanuatu. But what exactly will communities see come from this?
One intervention that we'd be looking at under this project is increasing the availability of nutritious food sources by increasing access to fish.
You'll hear more on that project coming up in about 20 minutes' time. Also, if you're an architecture lover, we've got a great chat for you. The Baha'i community in PNG are building a temple, and you'll hear from the architect about how he's created a space for worship. First, though, many Pacific Islanders are celebrating that win of the Labor Party in Australia as a win for climate action. The Labor Party has promised to do more to protect the climate, but also a number of independents in Melbourne and Sydney and the Greens in Brisbane won seats, and they also heavily campaigned on climate action. Dubravka Volida reports.
Tonight, the Australian people have voted for change.
For Australian voters, climate change and action on climate was a key factor in deciding how they voted on election day. A cut of 43% to carbon emissions by the end of the decade was Labor's position on climate change. While that plan has the backing of business groups, environmentalists say it should be more ambitious. It's a position held by some independents and the Greens MPs who want a reduction target of up to 60%.
I think the hope is that the independents and the Greens, now that they have more power, will hold Labor more accountable to the promises that they have made, but also to their current policy. We say that we're celebrating that Labor had won this election because we know it's a step in the right direction.
Labor voter Joseph Sikulu is from the environmental organisation 350.org in Australia.
But we know it's just a small step because their current policy already isn't good enough to match the action that is needed.
What is needed, he says, is more action and a more ambitious emissions reduction target. He says Pacific communities in Australia were out in droves to vote for climate action.
The conversation has definitely shifted over the last few years as we follow things across the Pacific community in terms of the conversation around climate. And I definitely think that has shifted with this election because we can see in elections where our people normally live that they have actually voted for the constituents, voted for representation that represents climate.
Cook Island Australian Louisa Nifmet from Western Sydney also voted for Labor.
I am actually quite excited with the change, massive change. I think for me, it's more like people are coming out to vote and also want to be heard. You know, there's louder noises now than before with the candidates that had won their seat. It's an amazing result, actually, you know, with Labor. And then there's the Greens and the Independents also.
The cost of living, the economy and climate action were key priority areas. Across the Pacific, the Australian government's shift in climate policy has also been welcomed.
The outcome of the elections in Australia is, I believe, very significant for us as Pacific Islanders. The key issue, of course, is climate change. From what we can see as a result of the votes, climate change played a very important role in how people voted.
Reverend James Bhagwan from the Pacific Conference of Churches in Fiji.
While Australian government continues to give its support to mitigation and adaptation, which are important and necessary support mechanisms, at the same time working within its communities, within its national borders on the issue of coal and fossil fuels, and joining Pacific, particularly in advocating as a joint message.
But just how much commitment the Labor Party is prepared to give remains to be seen. Senior Labor figure Katie Gallagher says the party has no plans to increase its emission reduction target.
Well, we've made it clear through the campaign, and we're not changing that we will implement the policy we took to the Australian people, and that had an emissions reduction target of 43%.
Lavitina Langi Seru from the group the Pacific Islands Climate Action Network is also keeping an eye on Australia's new government and wants greater ambition in its approach to climate.
This is a welcomed change to see that a government that has come into power with more progressive climate policies that they intend to roll out. But we certainly think there needs to be more that needs to be done.
He hopes the new government will morph into one of the global leaders in the fight against climate change.
Dubravka Volodar reporting there. Now, the volcanic eruption that rocked Tonga back in January quite literally sent shockwaves around the world. And now the latest research has confirmed that it was the biggest volcanic explosion yet recorded by modern sensors. A team of more than 70 scientists analysed a huge database and found the enormous blast was a once-in-a-100-year phenomenon. But as Marion Farr reports, the scientists' findings could also help in predicting similar future catastrophes before they strike.
When a huge underwater volcano exploded in Tonga earlier this year, it shook the globe.
An underwater volcano off Tonga has erupted, triggering a tsunami warning for several South Pacific island nations.
The eruption of an underwater volcano in the Pacific has seen Tonga's capital flooded by a tsunami and covered in ash.
The explosion was heard as far away as Alaska in the United States and felt in nearby countries including Fiji and New Zealand. But it was sounds that couldn't be heard by humans that travelled even further.
This was basically a once-in-a-century event.
Anna Pertu is a New Zealand-based volcanologist and part of the team that studied the Hunga Tonga eruption. In all, more than 70 scientists have examined different types of sound waves generated by the explosion, and their findings have been published in the journal Science. One thing they discovered was a special type of atmospheric wave called a LAM wave, which cannot be detected by the human ear.
They're really rare, and they're related to really large displacements of air volumes, and then they propagate along the Earth's surface.
The scientists say it's the biggest volcanic eruption ever recorded using modern instruments.
This event was spectacular in that we haven't seen some of these phenomena since we've had these really detailed geophysical networks.
The largest comparable event was the eruption of the Krakatoa volcano in Indonesia in 1883, a disaster which claimed 30,000 lives. Ms. Pertu says that explosion also generated LAM waves that rippled around the Earth several times.
We had to go back to the 1883 eruption of Krakatoa in order to find something similar in size.
Was this LAM wave bigger than Krakatoa, the one created by Krakatoa?
What you have to remember is that in 1883, we had really different sensors that we used to detect these things. From what we can tell, they are very comparable, but the exact percentage different, I think we're going to need to do some more work to kind of tease that out.
Scientists say it was these LAM waves that were responsible for creating the tsunami waves that swept across Tonga after the volcanic blast.
So the vast majority of tsunamis are caused by sudden changes in the ocean floor due to earthquakes, whereas this was basically the atmosphere pushing on the surface of the ocean.
Ms. Pertu says this rare type of tsunami is more difficult to predict.
These do travel so much faster, you know, across the Pacific than a traditional tsunami. So the waves were arriving earlier than what was predicted based on the models, which are based on kind of a traditional tsunami model.
Tonga's volcanic eruption claimed 6 lives and caused damage that has left a $90 million hole in the economy of a country that is still recovering from the devastating impact of the natural disaster. But volcanologist Anna Pertu says the information gathered from the explosion can help with disaster preparedness in the future.
So now that we have this really nice data set of these types of tsunami, we can work that into these early warning systems. But again, these are really, really rare events.
Professor Corentin Codron, who also contributed to the research, says scientists now have a huge amount of instruments to measure events like Hunga Tonga.
We had and we still have a huge amount of instruments. So I think in total we use more than 3,000 sensors or instruments, which are all deployed, let's say, over the globe.
Professor Codron says the Tonga eruption will generate research for years to come.
That was Marion Farr ending that report with additional reporting by Joshua Boschini.
Hold the front page!
Now it's time to find out all the news making headlines around the region, and I'm joined by Faith McCarley. Good morning, Faith.
Good morning, Jordan, and good morning to everyone listening.
Faith, we're starting off in Papua New Guinea. The news that you've got for us is that Sam Basil Jr. will be contesting for the Bulolo seat. What else do we know?
Yes, so United Labour Party announced that the son of the late Deputy Prime Minister would contest the seat, and Post Courier report that Chris Nangoy from the ULP formally announced to the people attending the burial of the late Bulolo MP and that his family agreed for his eldest son, Sam Basil Jr., to follow his father's footsteps in politics. And the announcement has received support from people who attended the burial and from the supporters of Sam Basil throughout the country.
Yeah, obviously still a very sad time for people in PNG following the death of Sam Basil. But seeing that his son will be following in his footsteps, perhaps providing some comfort. Faith, let's head over now to Vanuatu and Samoa, because they've announced that they will be reopening borders in the coming months. But more Pacific Islands are looking to rejoin the world. Tell us more.
Yeah, so the Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia, two countries that have not recorded any COVID-19 community cases, are preparing to reopen their borders. Federated States of Micronesia announced that it is planning to open its borders without quarantine beginning on the 1st of August, while Marshall Islands has gradually reduced its quarantine requirements since late last year. And the country's top government administrator said on Friday that it is no longer realistic and sustainable to maintain the 2.5-year border closure. New Zealand reports that the latter, who has maintained one of the strictest COVID prevention systems, is expected to further reduce quarantine as early as next month.
Yeah, some very exciting news. Of course, still having to balance that with what does that mean for COVID? What does it mean for the health systems in these countries, of course? But as we're seeing around the world, many countries are unable to actually keep their borders shut. And tourism, a massive part of the economies of these countries. If you had to go to one Pacific Island country for a holiday, where would you go?
Oh, I'm really looking forward to going to the beaches of Fiji.
Are you planning to go?
I am planning to go. Hopefully sometime when it gets colder in Melbourne, I'll be in the sunny Fiji.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, Fiji, I feel like, is a number one pick for so many people.
Yeah.
I really want to go to Kiribati. I saw some photos the other day. And because it's probably a less developed place, just the scenery, the water, crystal blue, lush jungles, just so beautiful. I love it so much. How exciting to be going to Fiji. You're right, because it gets freezing and cold here in Melbourne.
It does.
Hanging out in Fiji, it would be amazing. From Fiji, let's head over to Solomon Islands, where police are investigating a case of sorcery-related revenge. What else do we know?
Yes, so police are investigating a murder case that was allegedly revenge killing, a retaliation to a sorcery incident that happened earlier. Officials say that the alleged sorcery act resulted in a violent retaliation by relatives of the alleged victims, who burned down four dwelling houses and a kitchen. Solomon Times reports that the suspects have been identified in relation to the murder case, and police officers are working close with community leaders for their arrest. And police then calls on the community not to take the law into their own hands, as it might cause disharmony, disunity, and loss of lives.
Yeah, a very tragic story there. But of course, important to report on it and shine a light on what's happening out there in Solomon Islands. Faith McCullough, thank you so much for bringing us those updates.
Thank you for having me.
Can You Be More Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halatau. catch up on all the latest sporting news and meet the biggest personalities in sport from across the Pacific region.
You showed your skills on the weekend with your tip on.
Oh, my little try assist. Stop it. Don't even know how I ended up there. Probably a fatigue. Yeah. Probably should have been in midfield, but whatever.
Did you get hit after you passed the ball?
Yeah, I did. I was really winded. And I was like down and I was gasping for air and like I saw my life flash before me and I'm thinking about my family and like, you know, how they're going to deal without me. And physio runs onto the field and she's like, says, like, talk to me. And I was like, put my head up and kid you not, first words that came out of my mouth was, did she score the try? She's like, yeah, she scored the try. I was like, well, just get me off this field and put me in the change room.
Can you be more Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halatau?
Anyway, it's not about me in this moment. It's not about me. Oh, it actually is. We're up to the Super W final part.
Thursday night, 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Jordan Fennell with you here on the ABC's Pacific Beat. Now, a multi-million-dollar climate finance deal has been launched in Vanuatu with the aim of investing in community-based climate change adaptation. The $47 million Australian dollars, which is coming from the Green Climate Fund, Vanuatu's government, Australia's government and the NGO Save the Children, is the largest investment of its kind in the Pacific. But how much of an impact is this actually going to have? Well, I spoke with Save the Children's Vanuatu country director, Luke Ebbs.
Climate change, what that looks like in Vanuatu and what this project is trying to address is specifically two aspects of climate change. The first one is changing rainfall patterns, which is leading to increased severity and frequency of things like droughts and floods. And the second aspect is increasingly prevalent and powerful storms that are impacting the Pacific, most notably cyclones.
$47 million, it's a lot of money. What is going to practically come out of this project? What are people in communities actually going to see come out of this money flowing to them?
So what this project aims to do is work with local government and with communities to go to the community level and look at what are the risks that communities face as a result of these climate changes, as a result of the changing rainfall patterns, and as a result of the increased power and frequency of these storms. So what do they actually look like? One of the areas that this project will focus on is fisheries. So with climate change leading to changing rainfall patterns and increased frequency and severity of disasters, that obviously affects food sources. And access to nutritious food like proteins is obviously really essential for healthy children, healthy communities. One intervention that we'd be looking at under this project is increasing the availability of nutritious food sources by increasing access to fish. Through, for example, the installation of fishing aggregator devices, which attract more fish to a particular location, which makes it easier for communities in Vanuatu to access fish as a food store, as a food source in a way that's sustainable.
And when you say that you're working with the communities to bring this project to life and the different smaller projects that will come in under this funding, what sort of, I guess, dialogue will you be having with people in those communities? Are you setting up forums or how will you be talking to them and hearing from them about what they feel like they need?
Most communities in Vanuatu have existing structures that they use for community governance. They might include structures that have been set up by the church. They might include traditional structures rooted in the chief system of governance in Vanuatu. So we would be working with communities to identify what structures already exist in the first place, and we would work to strengthen those structures. And if there are no structures in place, then we would work to set those up. So we have lots of experience working with local government and communities to set up these community disaster and climate change committees, who are made up of volunteers in the community and made up of a diverse group of community members that represent different stakeholder interests. So we usually have an equal gender balance on those committees and try to bring in representatives of people living with disabilities into those committees.
With this amount of money, $47 million Australian dollars, with
things like this, with money coming from overseas, what sort of checks and balances are in place to make sure that that money actually flows through to communities? I'm sure there's sometimes a bit of anxiety around, you know, money getting sucked up into administrative things. What do you have in place? What structures do you have in place to make sure that that money is going directly to communities?
Well, Save the Children globally has, you know, principles, standards, guidelines to ensure that the appropriate level of funding is reaching service delivery and communities, and, you know, most essentially for us, children. We also need to be accredited to a fund like the Green Climate Fund, which means that we need to demonstrate to the Green Climate Fund that we have all the policies, procedures, and expertise in place to ensure that the funding that they entrust Save the Children with is reaching the people that we say it's going to reach. In this case, you know, over 90,000 direct beneficiaries in some of the most vulnerable, climate vulnerable communities across Vanuatu. We'll also be working with Government of Vanuatu as a key partner. And the Government of Vanuatu also has their own kind of processes and checks and balances that we would be working with and strengthening through the delivery of this project, including an oversight committee called the National Advisory Board that monitors the effectiveness and impact of climate projects from different funding sources, including the Green Climate Fund.
And when does this project, or maybe I guess this money, when does it hit the shores of Vanuatu? When will people start to see this money, I guess, coming into their communities and all that dialogue happening to begin these projects?
We expect that the money will be accessible and project activities will begin to start in the next few weeks once some final contracting issues are worked out. We expect, you know, the first 12 months to be really focused on that foundational work to set the project up for success. And it is a six-year project. So over that period, you know, we really are looking forward to seeing the outcomes for kids, which is essentially that children and their families are better able to adapt to the impacts of a changing climate.
That was Save the Children's Acting Pacific Regional Director, Luke Ebbs. And if you're in Vanuatu, I would love to know what you think about this investment. Is this how you think money should be invested into climate adaptation for your community? Let me know what you think. Head over to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. Taking you now over to Papua New Guinea, where the Baha'i community are about to open a new house of worship in Port Moresby. The ABC's Meredith Lake spoke with community member Zha Agabe Granfa and Baha'i architect Saeed Granfa about what the building means and how it will be used.
The Baha'i community in Papua New Guinea, it's essentially predominantly rural. There's approximately a range of around 60,000 people across the country. And it's primarily indigenous to Papua New Guinea. It's a vibrant community life, you know. And so consistent with what happens around the world in the Baha'i communities, you know, there's activities and community building activities that are done at the level of children in terms of children's education with young people and junior youth, call them. Youth and even adults, and trying to inspire a life that's not just about personal development and, you know, spiritual development, but also contributing to one's society.
You mentioned, Zha, that the majority of the Baha'i community in Papua New Guinea is rural, although I understand there's a temple under construction at the moment not far from Port Moresby. So, in the absence of a temple and perhaps in more rural areas, where do Baha'is worship?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing. So in terms of practice, people worship, you know, in their homes, at the village or rural level. Sometimes they, you know, communities will construct a little dedicated space or a little hut, if you can imagine that, where it's usually quite humble and simple. And that's where maybe collective devotional sort of prayers can be said together. Yeah, like I guess you mentioned the house of worship that's being built. It's very much a national icon that's is basically a symbol of what's already happening across the country, where Baha'is and their friends, their family are coming together. And they're not necessarily all from the Baha'i community. We already know that a significant amount of people that come together for those devotional sort of gatherings are also from the wider community. So, the spaces can be quite flexible. So in terms of how Baha'is pray, it can be at home. Personal prayer is not restricted or restricted to just a temple, for example, or collective prayer is not necessarily restricted to a house of worship. But certainly a house of worship as a space is very distinct and has very special atmosphere in its own right.
I'd love to explore that a little bit more and learn about, I guess, the plans for this temple that's being built in Port Moresby. Saeed, could you just describe what the building is going to look like? I mean, I understand, and this is common to Baha'i temples, I think, it's going to have quite a large dome. Why is that?
I think the dominant form or the design concept, as you may have seen, it's that of weaving. And this concept was from the very beginning very well received by the national governing body of the Baha'i community here. And it did evolve and was refined over a long period. It was something like 18 months with the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'i community here. In terms of the dome, yes, I think most houses of worship represent a large dome. They're nine-sided. But apart from those two facts, I think you'll also see a lot of diversity in the forms and concepts behind them. So each is to also reflect the culture of the locality in which it's built.
I've seen an image of the planned temple, and the weaving is quite extraordinary. It kind of rises up all the way up to the top of the dome. It pointed in two directions when I looked at the picture. One, of course, to weaving as one of the most, you know, refined, practical and artistic, you know, pursuits of communities in Papua New Guinea. And also to a kind of a principle of, well, you mentioned it earlier, this kind of interweaving of different traditions into a kind of a common tapestry. Could you elaborate a bit on why weaving?
It's a beautiful observation. The brief for the project called for a universally Papua New Guinean theme, which in the context of the many cultures here was a challenge. And I should also at this point mention that there are two architects involved, namely Henry Lape, a local architect, indigenous Papua New Guinean architect, and myself. And we really reflected on this theme of universality, and actually independently came across this idea of this notion of weaving being a universally Papua New Guinean theme, being very beautiful in form, and also having this conceptual strength of one way to look at it is that the individual strands are of a woven basket, for example, are in themselves relatively weak in comparison with the woven form, the woven basket, the woven bag or sail or wall or sculpture, which can be built out of it. So conceptually also this idea of weaving we thought had potential and strength.
Saeed, I noticed too that there are nine planned entrance canopies. Is nine a significant number? Just because I've noticed it recurring in other recent Baha'i temple designs, which have been taking place in other parts of the world in recent years. What's the significance of that number?
In the Baha'i faith, it represents comprehensiveness or culmination in a sense that it's the largest single digit before you have to start making numbers up of multiple digits, and includes all the others, which is one aspect. Another is that the number nine is also the numerical value of the name Baha, which means glory. and from which the Baha'i faith derives, the name of the founder being Baha'u'llah.
Baha'i architect Saeed Granfar speaking there. And if you want to hear more of that interview, you can head over to the ABC Listen app and search for the program Soul Search. The full 20-minute interview can be found there.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat. And China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi looks set to visit at least five Pacific Island nations over the next 2 weeks. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manasa Sogavare publicly confirmed that Honiara will receive a high-level visit from the People's Republic of China government later this week. For more details on this, I'm joined by Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Jordan.
Stephen, what will Minister Wang Yi's upcoming visit to Solomon Islands involve?
Well, we don't know exactly at this stage. All that the Solomon Islands government has said is that he will hold meetings with Manasa Sogavare, the Prime Minister, as well as Jeremiah Manele, his Solomon Islands counterpart. Now, the Solomon Islands government also said yesterday that he would sign a number of significant agreements, but we don't know exactly what those agreements are or what they involve. And we also don't know whether that might involve a formal signing ceremony for the very, very deeply contentious and controversial security pact between Solomon Islands and China. Now, both countries have agreed to that pact. So in a sense, it's already done and dusted. But there has been a suggestion from Australian authorities that they believe that there might be some sort of signing ceremony conducted by the two foreign ministers. The only other thing we know about it is that it looks like his leg, if you like, in the Solomon Islands will be about 1 day or so. He'll arrive, we think, late on Wednesday, and then he'll spend all of Thursday in Honiara before heading off either that night or Friday morning.
And then beyond travelling to Solomon Islands, what else do we know about where else he'll be travelling around the Pacific?
Well, to some extent, it's still a little bit of a mystery tour because the Chinese government hasn't yet publicly confirmed it beyond a statement from the Chinese ambassador in Honiara with Manasa Sogavare for the Solomon Islands League. But we do know that he's going to visit at least two other countries, and almost certainly more. The two other countries we're fairly sure about are Fiji. We believe that he's going to be in Suva this coming weekend, as well as on the Monday after that. And we also believe that he's going to visit Port Moresby around the middle of next week, around June the 2nd and the 3rd. So that's what we do know. Obviously, that leaves a few gaps, probably gaps for at least another couple of countries. So that's why we believe that there will probably be five visits on the country. But we don't know exactly which countries they will be. And honestly, the fact that this hasn't yet been announced formally, the entire trip by the Chinese Foreign Ministry, and has been the subject of such sort of swirling speculation in many other Pacific Island countries, does seem to suggest that the Chinese Foreign Ministry may still even now be nailing down the precise details. Now, the countries that it may well include, it could include, for example, potentially Kiribati, which, of course, has only relatively recently recognized China. It could also potentially include either Tonga or Samoa, which have also been listed. And the other one that people have murmured about, although this hasn't been confirmed, is Vanuatu. So I think it's pretty safe to say that at least one or two of those other countries will be included, but we'll have to wait and see exactly what the final itinerary looks like when it's unveiled by the Chinese Foreign Ministry.
Obviously, the timing of this comes just after Australia's held its federal election. How significant is this visit for the Foreign Minister of China to be visiting the Pacific region?
Look, it's pretty significant. It's not surprising that the Chinese foreign minister would do this. After all, China has relations with all of these countries. It's a significant player in the Pacific. It's got very substantial, in particular, commercial ties with many Pacific Island countries. And, of course, it's also a relatively substantial donor of development, though it's still dwarfed, we should keep this in perspective, by the development spending of countries, in particular, like Australia and, to a lesser extent, New Zealand in the region. But it is significant, and the symbolism is also significant. I imagine there'll be a number of agreements signed in each of these countries. When Wang Yi travels, he tends to come with a delegation, which often includes not only government figures, but potentially people from state financial institutions and the like. So I think this is another symbol of China's determination to ramp up its strategic ambitions in the region and to really cement both commercial and potentially security ties with the region. There has been speculation that Solomon Islands won't be the only country to sign a security pact with China, and that potentially one or two others might follow. There's been reporting from the Financial Times that Kiribati has been exploring a similar security agreement with China. Now, that's been denied by the government of Kiribati. It's absolutely important to put on the record. But Australian officials remain anxious, rightly or not, that this is something that China is aiming to do with other countries as it tries to build a web of security agreements with Pacific Island nations, which are friendly to it. They are very anxious about this prospect, and that's why they're monitoring this visit so closely.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out across the next 2 weeks. But thank you so much for bringing us those updates on that upcoming visit. Stephen Jedgetts, thanks for joining the program.
Thanks so much.
Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts speaking there. Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat. Over in Papua New Guinea, the first female neurosurgeon is hoping to inspire other women to take up work in the field. Dr. Esther Apuahe graduated in neurosurgery from the University of Papua New Guinea in April. She was also the first PNG woman to graduate in surgery in 2012. And she spoke to reporter Belinda Cora and said that despite the accolades, she's just getting on with her job.
It actually hasn't dawned on me yet. It's just become like it's a normal thing. Like, I don't feel different or anything, but I know that my achievement has inspired a lot of young ladies there to be, you know, what they want to be. And that's what I think, that's the thing that, you know, makes me happy, is to know that I'm inspiring a lot of females to be what they want to be, to better themselves, to get up there. So especially in the medical field, I see a lot of young girls coming through and saying, thank you. And this is, you know, it's just a feeling that, oh, okay, at least I've done this. And it's inspiring them to be more than, we are not just doctors, and then we go and we can get to at the next level and keep climbing up to, you know, be somebody.
Doctor, I understand also that it wasn't a tough journey for you to actually take up this very dream of becoming a neurosurgeon, just instead of just being an ordinary surgeon here in the country. How tough was that for you, especially now that I know that you, and I've read that you are married with three children? How tough is it for you to make a decision like this, especially in a society here in Papua New Guinea, where generally yet women are still seen to be not so seen to be dominating in a field like this, and we are slowly coming out of that? But how tough was that for you to consider, and, you know, what were you able to try to consider before you took on this role, and especially the backing of your partner and your family?
I think that for me, the journey, yes, it was challenging, but having that support from your husband, even though a non-medical person, if you, this, I think it's more of a communication and talking to them and telling them what is required of you, what I want to achieve, firstly, and how I will achieve that with their support and having them understand that, you know, it will take you away from home long hours, sometimes even for 24 hours, not seeing them. But those, it's the understanding that this is the role I play, or this is how, if I want to be a neurosurgeon, then this is what's expected of me. So, and having their support from the start makes it easier for you. And as I've been saying to the others, is that if your home is okay and you you have the support at home, working in your field becomes easier because you don't have so many things to worry about, because you know the support system is there and they'll be there for you. The main thing, if they understand what you want to achieve and what is expected of you, then it becomes easier. So the family support and having them understanding what you are or what you want to achieve and how to get there is very important.
Neurosurgery in Papua New Guinea isn't something that people talk about every day during their conversations at home, but from your perspective and from your studies and from what you were able to research over the years as a surgeon and now into neurosurgery, how important is this field and this course to Papua New Guinea itself and to the people who may not understand how important it is to them, especially when it finally dawns on them that they need this field to help them. How important is neurosurgery in Papua New Guinea for the sake of ensuring people are able to get the help that they need?
Being a general surgeon, you operate, but it's more like you're being superficial. You can operate from the head to toe, but it's superficial, meaning you do what you can, the best you can, but it's not in depth, and you know sometimes the outcome is not good. But to specialize into a certain field like neurosurgery, just concentrating on the brain, you become more knowledgeable about this small space that's in your skull, the organ. So you study it very carefully and you know that, okay, if I do this, then patient will be paralyzed. So if I don't do this, you know, this is going to be the outcome. So specializing further and doing just focusing on one gives you a better understanding, and you're more in depth with just managing conditions of the brain. So whether it be from trauma or from tumors or from infection, or you know, this, you are the person, you are the one with the knowledge to, oh, this is the way to go. No, we cannot just open up like this is how we want to manage this patient. So it gives you that more in-depth knowledge on a certain, so for me, in-depth knowledge on the brain, where it's safer to enter, where it's not, or if I do this, this is going to be the outcome. So it's an in-depth knowledge about the brain and what's the best option, what's the best way to approach a problem in the brain and all this. And then you find that the outcome on the patient becomes, you can tell your patient, oh, if I do this and that, then this is the outcome. If I don't do this, then, so you have that knowledge, so you can educate your patient, and then they decide, oh, doctor, I'll stay here and, you know, you can operate me, or I'll take this option, or can I go overseas? And always have that option that, yes, you can still go overseas if you're financially capable. Allow them to have that choice as well.
PNG's first female neurosurgeon, Dr. Esther Apua-Hayes, speaking there. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia for this morning. Stick around, though, for the 5 minutes of the news, and then later on this afternoon, 3 p.m. PNG time, we will have the afternoon show. Thank you so very much for your company here on this Tuesday morning. My name is Jordan Fennell.